podcast that was Christmas.
Hello, and welcome to episode 62 of If This Is a Podcast, Then What's Christmas? This is a conversation with Colin Gregg, the director of the peerless, wonderful classic ad from 1996, Blackcurrant Tango. It's actually the first of a series of three podcasts I've done on Blackcurrant Tango. The first is with Colin, the second was with Chaz Bayfield, the copywriter, and the third is with David Atter, the client. So obviously feel free to listen to those two as well. And the reason I've done that is because Blackcurrant Tango seems to hold a peculiarly massive amount of affection for a lot of people. If you're of a certain age, if you started in the 90s around this time, which I did, but also, I mean, I think people who weren't in the industry loved it. People who were in the industry loved it. A lot of people say it's the reason they got into the industry. You can still say it now, and people will immediately think of Ray Gardner walking through the office and then ending up in the White Cliffs of Dover, being mildly xenophobic in a way that was, hey, it was fine in 1996, and probably wouldn't be quite as fine now, or it'd be a bit weirdly Brexity. Oh, I don't know. So, in my desire to thoroughly explore this commercial, the chat with Colin, we get into all the technicals, but also into how he ended up being chosen to do it. And you'll hear more about that from Chaz, in fact, as well. Just spoiler alert, Hal Henry didn't really use the same director twice. So Colin says at the end, oh, they never asked me to do another ad. And I found out in speaking to Chaz, that's why they never used the same director again. So Colin, one of his first ever ads, just knocked it straight out of the park and created something amazing and did a really fantastic job as a director. So you can now hear all about that in my chat with Colin Gregg. Perfect. Thank you so much. I mean, I don't know if you've seen any, because I think at least one other person has looped you into the reaction Blackcurrant Tango has been getting when I put it up on LinkedIn maybe a week ago. It's still, people are still remarking on it and stuff.
I had a look, and Mr. Gash had briefed me as well about it, and he'd given me a little background about it, and I had a little check on your site as well, on your LinkedIn site, and I did. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, I didn't know it was 24 years old. That's a scary thing.
Yeah.
I got the script here, 27th of March, 1996. My son was 6 years old. He's now 30.
Well, so you've got the actual script that you were sent.
Do you know what? I have the script, and I know I was sent a script before this particular script, because I remember very clearly going in for a meeting with Chaz and Jim, and I remember there was one line missing from the script, which was, this ad is one continuous shot. That was not in the script that they gave me. I know it wasn't in the script, but I remember very clearly. And I remember going in for that meeting, and I remember saying, do you know, this would work really well as a single shot. And then they slipped another piece of paper over towards me, which was a script which had that line added. Which is, we see this as a continuous shot. Now, I know that I've met them since. I don't think I've actually discussed it with them, but I do remember quite clearly that was my particular vision. And I also think the other people that were up for the job as well, I think they had that similar vision that it could be just a single shot. It could be just one big developing shot.
But I guess there are several scripts that could be a single shot, but it's clearly a more logistical difficulty to take on. And I guess when you're looking at that, going, okay, it starts in an office building. I assume that's what it was when you first got the script, and then it ends up on the White Cliffs of Dover.
Yes.
What made you think that that should be or could be a continuous shot?
I think it's because I've always had the obsession for a single shot. I think, and also that I was able to pretty much taken a continuous shot that I'd just been working. I'd worked I worked for Channel 4. I'd worked on independent movies that I'd produced and directed, on small budget films that I'd actually commissioned. I'd then gone into mainstream TV. I'd worked a lot for the BBC, but I'd worked particularly with one producer on a cop series. And I'd actually just done that. I'd just done a continuous shot for that particular series. And it wasn't that the shot itself could be just mirrored in the Black Current Tango script. It was just that I was using some of the devices that I would then go on and use in Black Current Tango. And so in my mind, when I read it, I just saw it as a single shot. And also, I had sort of stumbled into advertising about a year before that with Harry Rankin and Eclipse Films, and I had a complete film and television discipline. So I didn't necessarily approach it as a commercials director. I think I approached it as I always thought, well, you know, I'd always admired either Scorsese's, you know, Goodfellas developing shot, or going back before that to Hitchcock, who would always try to do some sleight of hand developing shot.
Oh, yeah, right.
So that's how my approach was not. I didn't look at conventional advertising and thought, how would I do it as a commercials director? I just thought, how would I do it as what I always thought and still do think, that I was a film and TV director. That's how I looked at the approach to it. And I know that the technology was just really starting. So all the sort of technology that we use is stuff now that you can do on your laptop and it will render very quickly. Whereas in that time, we would often come back the morning after and it had rendered. And I always thought, I quite like the idea of doing some computer trickery that was like invisible mending. So I didn't want to morph an animal into something else. I wasn't interested in that kind of advertising. I was just quite interested in I just saw this as possibly a few shots that would, you'd have seamless joins. So it'd be a combination of sleight of hand, moving scenery, and computer technology. You had to have that.
Okay, we're staying on the technical side of it then. I think someone told me there were like two or three cuts, edit points. Where are they?
There's three shots, two edits. The first one is the first scene we shot in Croydon, in an office in Croydon, and Ray kind of walks past a wall.
Yeah, the wall.
Now that wall was just a movable wall, so we took that wall with. I don't think we didn't even have the photographs or whatever was on the wall. We just dropped that in later. But we just took that wall, and then we disappeared to a location in Welwyn Garden City, which was effectively a exit from an office block into a car park. So what we actually did, though, is we shot the first shot, which was in the office. And then we shot the last shot, which was coming out from the lorry to the White Cliffs of Dover, so that we could then work to length and slot in the middle slot, which is coming out of the office and going past the lorry. And obviously going past the lorry is the second shot. And if you look very carefully underneath the lorry, I think you'll suddenly see the we left it deliberately in. The tarmac turns to the earth of the field.
Right.
You can actually see it. You can see that we left that in. But it's effectively just working on a metronome and rehearsing. I mean, we rehearse for weeks, months. And I think the other reason maybe I got the job was that I hadn't really established myself into advertising. So I really didn't have any work. So I was kind of really fresh to advertising, so that I hadn't been molded, as it were. And I think this is what the appeal of the agency was, that I was still in a different world of filmmaking, and that I had a lot of time. I mean, a lot of very successful commercials director would not have the time. We did rehearse for months and months so that we could get the actual, all the acolytes behind Ray. They were all always in time. They were always doing this. They were always mirroring the same moves, whether they were in a car park in Welling Garden City or whether they were on the White Cliffs of Dover. So, yes, two joins, three shots.
And one other technical thing. I'm always amazed when he takes his trousers off that he doesn't kind of just get tangled up and trip over them. That seems to be a very smooth thing. Was that all very difficult to work out as well, in terms of how he changed his costume?
Yeah, at the time, I mean, I think I read somewhere where Chaz and Jim Bolton, I think, or Chaz Bayfield had said something that those shots, to do that particular thing, took a lot of takes. I think everything took a lot of takes because the mechanics were quite complex. And so whether it was a couple times he tripped over his Velcro trousers or a couple times that an acolyte wasn't in the right place or that Ray himself, I think the second cut, the morph, is when I think he puts his hand up and he says, "You're that Johnny French." I think that's when he does the second one. And I also thought that the best time to do, what I'd learned from television, the best time to do the sleight of hand, heavily aided obviously by computer technology at the time, was when the shots and the scenes were most active. You know, if you have a very slow, nothing's much is happening, it's so much easier to see the joins. It's so much easier for you to, it's so much harder to get that right. So he was always in full flow and he was always either moving. That made it a kind of a lot easier. But yes, I think everything took a while because it was quite complex. But I do know we had little kind of mechanics around his trousers. But the actor Ray Garden was just, you know, he just did it, always did it right. And always had, you know, he was always consistent.
But you say he was the actor. Was he not a Tango employee?
No. I think they gave him a job. I think they made him an employee. Again, you need to speak to the agency. But I think they gave him a job. I think he became an official member of Britvic. But no, he wasn't. And it's actually really interesting because that was the one. It was a very collaborative venture. Because I've always been collaborative, whether it's in TV or always in commercials, I'm collaborative with the agency and I'm very accommodating to the client. But Ray was very much somebody that the agency focused on immediately. And because I'd come from a TV background and quite kind of heavy drama, I was kind of looking at I was going in a slightly different direction. I remember that. And I remember thinking, well, isn't Ray larger than life? Isn't he kind of exactly the cliche that you know, you have actors in advertising slightly overacting? But no, he wasn't. And their instinct was fantastic. I mean, he was a larger than life character. And they were absolutely right, the agency. I mean, I didn't resist it at all. I didn't sort of disagree with it, but I had somebody else in mind, and thank God they got their way and Ray did the job. But no, he's an actor.
When you said you had someone else in mind, so what was the casting process for that?
Again, it was read-throughs. In fact, oddly enough, I came across a little bit of script just checking out here. And we did. I remember the guys wrote a kind of a rehearsal script, which was kind of much more heightened, much more much stronger language, just so that the actors themselves coming for the auditions could get this, you know, they could do something that was a bit longer rather than being very specifically doing the actual script. But no, it's pretty, we did lots of casting sessions, and in the end you know, it was whittled down to Ray and he got the job. But it was the whole process, again, because I had time on my hand, and they knew exactly that. The agency knew I had time on my hand, and they wanted to get it absolutely right, and they wanted to button it down. We used to go out in the offices just off Wigmore Street, therapy offices, and we used to come out of the office, go up the side street, and go into Wigmore Street doing our rehearsals with all the extras coming behind. So by the time we actually went to shoot it, it was the mechanics, you know, it was just getting the camera work right. But the performances had been sort of locked in by then.
And what also strikes me when I'm looking at the ending is, obviously you've got a cast of a lot of extras there, all coming over the hill and all that kind of stuff. And did you change from one camera to a different camera? Because when you're doing the tracking shot alongside the van, obviously the camera you have after that, was that a helicopter?
Yes, it was. Initially, it's handheld in the office. It then goes to a dolly coming out of the office, walking across the car park and the Britvic sign, and then going across the truck. That was a dolly just on rails. And then the shot after that, when he just comes out and you see the extras coming over the hill, and they were all extras. We weren't post-producing the extras because it was too complicated. Now maybe you could bump the numbers up, but those were the numbers we had. Then that went to a helicopter. I guess now you'd be doing it on a drone. But that was our only big problem, is that the weather changed quite substantially between the rehearsal day and the shoot day. So we ended up with a rehearsal day when it went very smoothly, and a shoot day when the field they were on had dried out so much that just the rotor blades just whipped up all the soil. We sent in bowsers to wet down the field, but it was absolutely impossible. So the helicopter just dropped down slightly down below, just right on the edge of the cliff, really. So he just dropped a little bit, managed to make an adjustment to that. But that's why I think we did the, that's why I know we, my instinct was, just again from experience, we did the ending as a second shot in the sequence, because we just didn't quite know how long it would take to play out that dialogue on the clifftop, make the circle around the ring, the boxing ring, and to back off out to sea. We didn't quite know. We had no idea how long that would take, because that's something you could not. You just couldn't. You had to do it. You know, you just had to shoot it. So then we knew that the bit we had to slot in the middle, which was the car park scene, we knew how, what we had to play with. And I think we were over. I think we were 93 seconds. I think there's no way we ever got it down to 90 seconds, so I think the whole thing was just very slightly sped up in the end.
Oh, right.
I think it's a little percentage faster than it should be.
Oh. I actually remember in the mid-90s, I was having lunch with somebody, and they were talking about the ad, and they said, I love the way that the Harrier jump jets kind of just wink at us at the end. Kind of nod. Is the movement of the, they bow. So was that a deliberate, the jump jets, they better bow and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, they kind of like, yeah. But actually it's quite interesting, because they called me again. We were always meeting either formally with the agency in the office to discuss the script, or informally out in the street during the rehearsals. But I think we did have a meeting when I came, they said, well, I got an idea for the end. And I said, I got an idea for the end. I have an idea, because it was some kind of anniversary. I said, why don't we back out? There's some Spitfires go out to sea. And they just said, we can do better than that. We want Harrier jump jets. So we tried to find out how much they'd cost to do the real things. But they were quite expensive to do them. But what was quite interesting about those 3D ones that we just put on was that how incredible it was that if you just wanted it to tilt a little bit, you kind of had to go away overnight for it to be processed. You know, you had to come back the next day, and if you didn't like it, you'd have to go away again and come back the next day. Whereas I say now, you probably just do it on your MacBook Pro. which was that was the kind of the limit of the technology at the time. It just it was quite slow to render everything, so it's that's why we had to be quite precise. But I do know also that things like when we did the sequence in front of the van, and Ray says, "You're that Johnny French," and I think we actually took his head off one shot and put it onto another shot, because just very slight different angle on the body would was quite impossible to match. So, you know, I think all that planning was really important, but because I think the technology wasn't so sophisticated, it could correct big mistakes. It couldn't.
Right. I'd also guess in this instance, the edit isn't one of those things where you go, well, we've got sort of 25 cuts and potentially 15 takes for each cut, and so you're looking at different edits that much. Is it just you have one a start that you liked, and then a middle that you liked, yes, and then an end, and that was it? There wasn't a lot of choice, or
no? There was it. There's never any choice, because you kind of stop.
Yeah.
When you think you've got it, and sometimes you stop because you've run out of light. I mean, I do know that when we were filming at the Welling Garden City, which is the car park, it was snowing.
Oh, right.
I think you can still see, you can see snow on it. But no, you had to, again, I'd done something quite similar. So I knew the challenges. I kind of knew the challenges. I think we had the post-production house, Frame Store, with us again, working with us. But no, there wasn't much choice. And you can always play around with voice. I think Ray was we did a little bit of post-syncing on him, just brought it back in the studio just to get different emphasis, because the creative team were very picky about the dialogue. I mean, nothing was ever changed on the dialogue. We shot the script just exactly as it was. There was no room, no need for any improvisation on it. It was so beautifully written. But the thing that also is very important is that it's the momentum as well. I mean, if you read the script, there are moments when the action stops, or at least in the description of the action, it's stops. So I could never allow that. He had to keep moving. And I do remember at one point the clients in the pre-production meeting said, "Can we at some point have a close-up of the can?" No, you can't have a close-up of the can. You know, we had a storyboard, which is kind of like we unrolled it like an old-fashioned school photograph. You know, they just kept unrolling, which is a storyboard, because this is a continuous shot. It's not going to, you know, and it has to build as his dialogue builds and his passion builds and his xenophobia builds. So in a way, that's got to be mirrored by the camera moves as well, and also by the extra people joining him and the music and everything. So no, it just had to go from A to B and just never stop and just keep building.
Were you aware of it being a, because I mean, thinking back to 1996, it was a time of Britpop. There was a sort of strange pride in the, not strange, but it was an unusual pride in the country that before then, if you had a St. George's flag, you were basically a sort of racist, and it wasn't necessarily a badge of honor to be proud of Britain or England. Did you feel like there was an element within this that you were going to capture of a kind of moment in time where English people were proud to be English, or British people were proud to be British?
I don't think I was particularly. I'm sure the creative team would feel that. I was very aware how kind of xenophobic it was. And I'm pretty sure that it would be pretty tough to make it now. For those reasons, I do remember seeing something, and I think a few years ago, not that long ago, suddenly the Sun newspaper had discovered the Black Currant Tango and said this is the first pro-Brexit commercial ever made.
Oh, God.
And it was made, and I think that's, and I do know that 68 people complained about it for being xenophobic. I think we just got a wonderful balance, really, of parody and a wonderful balance of humour in there, and of self-mocking. And I just think everything was so perfectly written by the lad, by the creative team. I can't put myself back into that. I just know that if you wouldn't get a script like that now, I just think there would be too many obstacles, too many reasons for you not to make it. Yeah. But no, I wasn't particularly aware at the time. I think all I realised was that I probably wasn't getting far in advertising. The transition wasn't going to be as easy. I never thought it'd be easy, but you could have a go at it for about a year, and if you didn't really get much work, and I was getting quite small amounts of work, but I did realise if I got this right, it would get attention. That's what I knew, that if I could get it right.
Well, I think that's another interesting question. Like, what was your experience as the director of it, in terms of the reaction it got, both in the industry and in the public?
Well, again, because I'd done so very little, I didn't know quite where it would sit in terms of the advertising circles. I didn't know how my peers would react to it. I had no preconceived ideas. All I could do was respond to how editors were feeling about it, putting together, and how the creative team, Chaz and Jim themselves, the creators, how they were responding to it. But I think, I think we all thought we had something quite unusual. For the fact it was 90 seconds for a start, but I thought we thought that was quite unusual, and for the fact it was a single shot, that we thought that would be it. But I don't think, I know we assembled in a pub in Soho, just off Charlotte Street, I think, to watch it on the big screen, and we felt fantastic about it, but I'm pretty sure that the creative team were really hoping it would get banned. I know they were very pleased it got so many complaints. Maybe in the end they were probably disappointed it didn't actually officially get pulled off the air, and it didn't run for very long. I think it was TFI Friday that time.
Oh yeah.
7.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that might have been where it was first shown.
Yeah, I think at some point, they're pretty sure they had Ray Gardner on TFI Friday.
They did.
In the pub.
They did.
In the bar.
They
yeah.
did. But, I think afterwards, you could see that it had a long legacy. And I know that some of the kind of quite distinguished commercials directors of the day were surprised that they didn't get sight of the script. But I know they wanted a novice to do it. I think they wanted somebody. And I do remember going in and talking to them about it, about the technicalities, how we're going to do it. And I remember them summoning me back for another meeting and say, can you just talk about the acting, please? I mean, can you talk about the performance? And because I was a drama director. To me, that was second nature, the actual working with the actors. And I thought what they were concerned about as an agency was, how are we going to physically make this work? But I think they didn't really have any doubt about how we were going to make it work. I think ultimately they wanted it also to be a wonderful performance piece, which I think Ray did. He achieved that.
Absolutely. I mean, the intention of this conversation, as I'm talking about conversation in the wider meaning of it, is to also talk to Chaz and perhaps Jim, if that's possible, and then also to the client and get their kind of perspective on that from a different angle.
Yes.
But I do think it's kind of fascinating that, in an industry where some people take a chance on someone who's, they've got a little spark in their reel somewhere, or they've done something a little bit different. But it feels like part of the reason they wanted someone with TV experience like you was to get that thing right. But also that Hal Henry, the agency itself, they didn't really do things in a conventional way, and I think that may have been what led to, and obviously it ended up very successful, but it was interesting that they took, in inverted commas, a chance on a different director.
But what was weird, and again, I know at the time, and I don't know whether I can't, you know, I'm just kind of paraphrasing my exact story, but I did actually get a job with the agency prior to it. It was, it wasn't a very good job. It wasn't great, and I think it's, the script wasn't necessarily great. It was Avon, I think. It was, and I don't necessarily, I wasn't working with a gem of writing, and I was doing my very best and, you know, doing almost my first or second job. But what I was led to believe, which is probably doesn't exist anymore, and maybe only existed in that agency, was that the creative team, they had the final say in everything. So once they picked the director, they just had to announce, you know, to the senior creatives who was doing it. And I'm not convinced that I would have got the job if the senior creative, if Axel and the others, had actually made the final decision about the director, because I didn't really have any evidence that I was going to... I mean, it took a vision, I think, by Chaz and Jim to realise that I was the one to do this, and I think it paid off. But I think when they announced that I was going to be the director for this, I'm sure there was a little eyebrows raised. You sure? Is that the person you want? So, I don't know. But I think also I kind of wanted a British sensibility about the thing. I do know that just casual conversations with them, that there were a couple other directors in the line that were much more from either a commercial background or from even, I think it might have been a couple of American directors in there as well, who kind of wanted to make the whole thing kind of just much brighter, much more stylized. And I think I kind of felt it should be like at the time, like Braveheart. Do you know what I mean? It should look grubby. It should look dull. If it was dull, if it was raining, all the better, because that's kind of suited the mood of the piece. So I didn't really want to embellish it with anything. I didn't really want to have flags that were particularly bright. I didn't want to have anything that was making it too stylized.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting. I think as a creative, you have something in mind, and from the outside, it may be that you know other people will look at it and go, "Well, surely you wanted X and Y, you know, whatever director, and to bring something else to it." But I think if you have something in mind, in terms of something like what you've just said, like a kind of, you know, rainy day, or you know, it looking or feeling very British and not being all whistles and bells, then that's in some ways the most important thing. And it's not that you want someone to come along and change that vision, but someone who can realize it. So
exactly. I mean, it was a wonderful script. I mean, it really was. I mean, I just was so desperate to get it. And and I just think that, again, from my experience in television and in film, is that I just know that if you have the right script, and that was a perfect script, and if you have the right performance, then I think, you know, my job is just to get the mechanics that will deliver the lines and will deliver the performance and we'll get the message. I think that was, so it was that combination of just the technicalities that I was quite experienced with, because I was working on a TV drama where I'd say to my producer there, I'd say that I want this first 3-4 minutes of this cop series to be one single shot. And can I trade off extras for cranes, this for steady cams, and for a little bit of overnight moonlighting with a post-production flame operator, just so we can do that. And I think that helped enormously, that I could show them something that I'd done that was kind of a seamless developing shot.
And just going slightly back to the reaction again, you know, I'm assuming, not coming from the industry, that you weren't really aware of, say, advertising awards that much. And
no.
So when it won a bunch, did that, Was that a big deal to you, or is it, oh yeah, okay, oh, well.
Yeah, no, it was. No, it really was, and I do remember. I think I was on a commercial in Hong Kong doing when I realised I'd got some good. No, it was, of course it was. I suddenly realised actually this. I suddenly realised that I'd if I was just going to do one piece of advertising, this was going to be a great piece. You know, I saw it again. You know, I'd look at Jonathan Glazer's stuff, you know, his Guinness commercials, and they were spectacular. And you'd be thinking, well, this guy's a genius. This guy does know how to make really great adverts that have a fantastic filmic quality to them. So I had sort of good standards up there. There were people out there that, you know, whose work I thought was just fantastic. And it could cross disciplines as well. It could be work you'd find in the cinema or work you'd find in advertising. But I think I just was so focused on my first proper job, and one that I just wanted to get right. I wasn't ever thinking about would it get me more work or would it get awards or yes, because I mean I you know, they were very important. It's a really strange thing is because I'd spent so long, because I started in film and I started in TV, I still write, and I had a long period in advertising, you know, a good 15, 16 years, less so now, almost none now, but I did sort of feel that I never quite entered the world of advertising. Do you know what I mean? I never really was part of it. I never felt I was really part of it. Like I felt I was very much part of when I used to work in TV. Maybe that was because, I don't know, I was younger when I was in TV. I came into advertising when I was kind of quite middle-aged, really. But I don't know. Yeah, so I tended then to get work that was very much always performance-based. And the people that seemed to take a long, long time to appreciate Black Current Tango it was in the States. They really never kind of got to grips with it. They really never quite understood. Took me, and they suddenly realised what it was, and then I got a lot of work. But yeah, no, I mean, you know what? I mean, this. I just think that if that's all I'd ever done in advertising, it was impressive.
Oh, absolutely. And you mentioned that Sun thing about Brexit a few years ago. What over the years have there been, you know, has it sort of flared up again in terms of a reaction or becoming, you know, talked about at various points?
We did have a reunion. We did have something 21. So 3 years ago, there was I can't remember, you know, some terrible, you'd have to ask Mr. Gash this, but he was there. But there was somebody who organised big kind of industry events where you'd invite people who'd made a commercial, they'd talk about the commercial, and then they'd sort of break down some commercials and discuss that. It was quite always very well attended, and I just went with wasn't with Ray. I think I went with Chaz and Jim and Peter Muggerston, the producer. My producer at the time, which was Anthony Taylor, we all went to that. And I think it was an event about a decade ago when it won the award for the best long-form commercial ever or something, or since 1965 or something. So those things sort of kind of kept it alive. And then people would say to me, you know, you'd say to somebody, people always ask you what you've ever done. And I'd always say, I'd never seen it. It was always done in the States. You know, I'd say, look, I did do this one called Black Current Tango, but it's so old now, but you can find it on YouTube. And people would always come back and say, wow, you know, I think that's pretty impressive stuff. So I don't know whether it stands the test of time. I guess it probably doesn't, but considering it's quite old now, I guess it's quite good that people still remember it.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's strange about it is I've just been putting up some ads from the 90s on LinkedIn. I do one a day just to kind of... I started doing it to kind of make a sort of point about how things were better then, and you know, maybe it's just my own rose-tinted glasses about when I started in the industry and things like that. But at the same time, it's got, I think, the biggest reaction of, you know, I've been putting really massive, quite classic ads from that time, but there's a much greater affection, I feel, for Blackcurrant Tango. It's a very likable ad in terms of, I don't just mean people like it, but I mean people really have a fondness and affection for it. So I think there's something that's different that sort of really got people at the time, and they still talk about it now, and I think it doesn't hurt that it's endlessly rewatchable. I mean, you kind of, aside from looking for the cut points, you can just watch, you know, Ray's little speech at the beginning again and again and again, and then, oh my God, what's he doing outside? And I was just showing it to my daughter the other day. She's 10, and obviously she hasn't seen it before, and she literally just spent the entire thing saying, what the fuck? I mean, I have to apologize for how badly I brought up my children, but that's what she said. But she's just going, what the fuck? And so all the way through the thing then. So even if you're 10 years old now in 2020, you can still find something to really sort of raise your eyebrows. It's not that it's been dated in any way. It's still got a kind of something to it that will elicit that reaction even from children in recent times.
Well, I think maybe it's because it does have that inherent drama that it starts very gently, and also we end up at the game. You need to show it in the cinema, but you do notice that by the time we get to the end, the actual black bars have come down, making it more cinema scope. I think the beginning we make it look like video, the middle is just quite ordinary. As it goes towards across the field, the format is getting wider and wider, more widescreen as well. So I think all that helps you get that kind of build and with the music as well. And I don't know, I'm not the person to say this anymore. I'm not in touch with necessary current thoughts about it, but I think there is something that's quite British about it. I can't imagine any other country doing it so mockingly, maybe, so with such kind of, you know, parody, such humour, and maybe when you look at the way the Brexit vote went, and maybe there's a whole pile of people out there that kind of like the Britishness of the piece, and they like the character of Ray, and your daughter just kind of likes it because she's not seen it. Is it quite unusual?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like you take from it whatever you want from your perspective. So I think if you're a Brexiteer, you might say, yeah, great, it's nicely, you know, sticks one up to the French people or something. But I think if you're not like that, you can say that. You can say that Ray Gardner's a bit of a dickhead, and he's a bit of an idiot, and you know, the way it all turns out, it kind of fits in with your perspective as well. So maybe there's something about that makes it a bit more universal.
Maybe, yes. I mean, I think I'm loath to sort of say that, because some people would find it's not nice being xenophobic, it's not nice being so anti-French about it. But I think, again, if it hadn't been played the way it would play, if it had been played more serious, if it had been played more aggressively, if the words hadn't started off so kind of reasoned, ended up quite so, not even angry, but just kind of passionate, you know. I just think if you strip away actually the xenophobia, you still find it funny. And I have occasionally over the years dipped into the YouTube, YouTube. There's a lot of YouTubes that are actually have it posted, and I just very occasionally scroll down on the comments. It is pretty universally admired and liked. And sometimes people say, I don't know what you're talking about, I don't know what people make all the fuss about, or is that. But as you say, I think it just resonates. I don't, for reasons that are probably beyond me, but I don't know. It'd be interesting to know what Chaz and Jim say, think and feel about it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have the screen open of one of the YouTube uploads right now. And the first one is someone saying, my absolute favorite TV ad, hands down. I've been in ad copywriting and production for years, and this is a masterpiece. The cutting and editing is as near perfect as I've ever seen. The two jumps when the building and outside are magical. And then the next one says, this could be a UKIP party election broadcast. My name's Nigel, and I'll fight you all, Europe.
There you are. That's it, isn't it? And so that's it, isn't it? I mean, it is everything from how the hell do they do that, I love Ray Gardner to, you know, wow, I love the jump jets at the end, and you know, how long ago was that? Was the YouTube comment?
I don't know if this is the Prime YouTube one. It's had 151,000 views, so I'm assuming it's not the one that everyone's seen. Because these comments are from, the first comment was from 4 years ago, and the UKIP one was from 5 years ago. So
yeah. Well, there may be a different link, or maybe it just has actually run its course now and just needs to be found again. But it's quite interesting, that Sun advert that said this is the first sort of pro-Brexit. Have we discovered a pro Brexit, the first pro Brexit commercial?
And I hope the answer was no. But there was one other thing I was going to ask you from a director's point of view. The music, was that always the music you were going to choose, or
that was always the music we were going to have? But that was the music was chosen by the creatives, which right. I thought was quite inspired. Yes. I mean, if they turn around and say, no, that wasn't the music, we didn't have it, then it's just that I've got it wrong. But I always assumed it was. I can't remember that we ever in our head had the, somebody did do the making of Blackcurrant Tango.
I'll have a look at that.
I think you find it on YouTube. Guy Bart, who used to work for Eclipse, the company that I was working with, Harry Rankin was the MD. He did the making of, and it's quite interesting because it's just is that everybody staring at monitors and scratching their brows. And, you know, it is. But I mean, there is that.
I found it. I should have watched that before, but
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's a bit of bad wardrobe on my part going on there. I don't know what I was thinking of, but there you go.
Well, I might add it to the link when I put this conversation up. And what's great is that I was planning for this to be 15 minutes, 15 minutes and 15 minutes of you and then the creatives and then the client. But fortunately, we've managed to talk quite easily about this for 45 minutes and probably could talk about it for a bit longer. But I think that I'll just put these up as individual conversations that people can...
Okay. Can
then have a listen to, because I think there is still an interest in what makes something, I guess, so culturally resonant that it's still enjoyed 20 years later, because there's not a lot of things that really applies to. Even more highly awarded ads of the time have kind of disappeared by the wayside and people sort of forgotten about them. But this one, as soon as you say the words Blackcurrant Tango, assuming, you know, people were born at least by, say, 1985, they'll know exactly what you're talking about, and it'll be remembered with affection. I don't think there's anyone who doesn't like this ad.
No, it's nice that. But I think that, you know, I was the hire and fire director, and you know, I just think if I was Chaz and Jim, I'd be really happy with it, even if they niggle about something, and if they were very picky about the way Ray said stuff, and they're very picky about it, his inflection. And I do remember we had some quite strong discussions about, I know how you hear it in your head, but Ray comes from a different part of the UK, and the one thing I'd learned a lot with working with actors is that, you know, dialogue is said differently throughout the regions. And I think I know there were some bits that, you know, they were very attentive to detail, which was fantastic. But I think in the end, every time we meet, and we were meeting because they wrote a brilliant script, and I think I just put a mirror to it and probably did it exactly how they wanted it to be. But they may have a different story. I mean, you have to remember that it's their commercial. They wrote it.
Absolutely.
That's that.
Cool. Well, I think that's everything. I guess I want to leave some space for the others to contribute and have their own memories of it, which would be fascinating too. But thanks so much for your time, Colin, and thanks so much for making such a wonderful ad.
Oh, brilliant! Thank you very much. No, thank you. I think there was I did see an interview with Shaz, I think, or something, which I'd kept. I kept a few odd things about it. I think they did interview him on the 20th anniversary, but it's best that you speak to him. But he had he has his perspective on it. I don't think it's any different, but it's just from the creator's point of view. Okay. His team was probably battling, you know, how do you sell that to a Britvic client? All I know is that at the time, I was amazed by how young the client was.
Yeah.
I think he was in his 20s. He seemed like he was in his 20s, the client.
Well, really weirdly, I was speaking to him somewhat coincidentally about a week or two ago about something else. And, because... You know, I put it up, and then there was sort of some mention of it, and then he got in touch on LinkedIn, and he was speaking to my wife about a completely different thing, unrelated. The next day, and I said, well, that is a very small world, but I'll get in touch with Dave, and he can tell me what his perspective on the whole thing is.
Yeah, it'd be interesting. Yeah, because I think the brand disappeared quite quickly. I think the Black Hand Tango didn't survive as a brand for very long.
Yeah, maybe it wasn't very nice to drink. I don't know.
It wasn't very. I remember we said to them at the time, "Oh, when he said, can we have a close up of the can?" No, you can't. Absolutely can't. You know, it's almost like, have you not been listening? I wouldn't say that to the client, but it's almost like, no, of course we can't. It's building a momentum. So we said, "Oh, we'll purple up the can a bit." We'll put a little bit more purple in the can. I mean, the can's a dot.
Yeah.
It's impossible. We'll play around with your logo, the sign outside the office. But you know, when they saw it, they didn't care.
Good.
Again, that's quite brave, isn't it? Really?
Very.
No cat.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of elements that make me think, you know, Dave was a very good client on this. So
it added 15 yes. million.
But I do hope you get to speak to one of the others. I have, I saw them about 3 years ago, and I think Chaz actually disappeared out of advertising altogether. Maybe he's come back into it, but I think he just disappeared altogether out of it. And all I know is. All I know is I never got another job with Howard Henry again, even though I used to go for interviews. I never got another job from them. Maybe just as well.
Maybe they like newcomers.
I think they do.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's it, isn't it?
Well, Howard Henry's now disappeared, so, you know.
I know it has.
It burned brightly, and then that was that.
It did. But how lucky am I for that, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thanks so much, Colin, and I'll put this together and send it over to you when it's done. And you know, again, I really appreciate the time and the commercial.
Okay, Ben, thank you very much.
Okay, nice thanks, talking Colin. To you. Thanks. Bye.
Cheers. Bye. Bye.
Podcast to watch Christmas.